Bill uses the term, what it demands of both, and some of the steps to achieve it. I want you to know I've told Joseph Campbell he doesn't have to answer all the questions completely. What happens to the projection when a relationship matures? Is there any left? Please address the possibility of a woman having an anima and a man having an animus.
Well, I must apologize. Can you hear it all?
Yes.
My voice. Apparently this has turned into a marriage counseling function. My own marriage has lasted 38 years, so I have a certain authority here, perhaps. But I think in answering these questions, first thing is to establish a priority of relationships. If you think your marriage is the main thing in your life, that's it. And then the secondary relationships must be sacrificed if they break into that. Otherwise, they have their claims. Now, relationship is like a ball game. You have to have a field in which to play. And one good field is the breakfast table. And when people use the breakfast table to read the newspaper, this is missing a shot. The mythology of marriage, long-term relationship, is very well expressed, I think, in the Roman Catholic idea that when you get married, you should have the intention of staying married. To marry, as so many of my friends do, thinking, well, if it doesn't go, it's going to bust. Can you marry again? That's not preparing for a long-term relationship. I remember when my wife and I, in this rickety car that I had at the time, right after our marriage, went up to Maverick, to the Maverick Road in Woodstock for our weekend honeymoon. A Hertz entered the road just before our car did. And I thought, that's a perfectly good time. This is going to last. So that's what I would say about relationships. You have to establish a field. And as in a tennis game, you've got to let the other person play too. It's a question of responses. It's a question of determination to make it work. It's a question of subordinating other relationships to the main one. Maybe that your marriage isn't the main relationship that you're interested in. Well, know that. And that ought to be communicated to the partner. My business is worth more to me than you are here. That sort of thing. And what else did we have in there? Oh, what happens to the projected anima? Well, in my case, it's still there, but it's also in other places. And one has to realize that the thing that has come along in the marriage of a person-to-person relationship and the kind of sense of identity that one gets, I don't know, I think people here who have been married a long enough time will know what I'm talking about. It occurred to me one time about a year ago when I was following in a kind of play way one of these guided meditations. You go down a long tunnel and you come to water and you get in a boat and you go in and that kind of thing. I was trying to play the game and I just realized that I wasn't alone and that I was always thinking that Jean was with me all the way. Well, that's a pretty good one. I had another experience at that time, a kind of ritual that was invented where each person should find name to himself the seven things without which he wouldn't want to live. and, oh, thank you very much. And having named these, find certain little objects that would remind them of these. And then came the ritual thing of entering a long cave. And as we went down, we didn't know this was going to happen. At the entrance of the cave was an initiator wearing a dog mask. He put out his hand and he said, "Give me that which you least cherish." Well, for some things you couldn't live without. I was surprised at the sequence that I found. We went through this cave and seven of these requests until at the end, give up that which you most cherish. A little game like that, something that will let you know what your primary relationship is. And I suggest you might try it sometime at one of these conferences. So much for relationship. Now, Louise, I have to thank this beautiful woman. She's been marvelous to me all the way, as has no end of help come to me from this community. About vitamin C tablets. Tristan, which I'd like to return to the owner of heaven on time. And a glorious concoction of honey and cinnamon and tea and lots of marvelous things. A good shot of bourbon added.
This question refers to the diagram that Joseph Campbell projected for us about the Jungian concept. How would the chart change when progress is made towards individuation? Please enlarge on the distinction between the ego and the self. Could you discuss the similarities between the superego and the persona, as well as the differences and the role of ego defenses in the structure you discussed Friday evening of the ego, shadow, and persona? The myth of old age as a time of disintegration. Speak to the joy and discovery of old age for all of us. As consciousness separates from the body and goes through the portal of death, does it retain its individuality? How does the idea, as expressed by Jung's fears of his fantasies and dreams reported in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, of keeping the unconscious from absorbing us, fit in with the idea you stated about allowing ourselves to be swallowed up and to go through a thing? Is there no little self and big self in Jungian psychology? How much is the psyche of the patient affected by the orientation of the therapist?
Well, about whether the individuality survives after death, I'm not competent to remark on that. But there are two distinct mythologies with respect to this. One is yes, the other is no. I do have some authority, since I've already passed my 3 score and 10. I think if you realize that the seasons have their values, and you don't look for blossoms when it's time to gather fruit, or expect to gather fruit when it's time for blossoms, you'll find old age pretty exciting. For me, after retirement 4 years ago, my first experience was of lifting weights from the shoulders me about 6 weeks. I realized that they were students. And I didn't realize that I had been taking them so seriously. And then the next experience was of having my reading come back to me as it had been during 5 years of the Depression, when I was without a job and had nothing to do but read what I liked. That was very exciting. And then I intentionally, and I think this is very important, embarked on a totally new life, one for which I was competent. Everyone, by the time he retires, is competent at something besides just doing the job the society had given him. And if he doesn't feel he's going to be competent when retirement comes, well, then he should get started on something, what we call a hobby. This is something that will really engage him. The little hobby I developed was taking pictures, and I showed you about 220 of them this week. I now have 10,000, and it has added a whole richness not only to my lectures but to my life to come in on this essentially visual aspect. And I realized that that visual aspect is the proper aspect of mythology. It is vision. It's made of vision. And I think this is what's important, really. Prepare ahead of time with the knowledge that it's going to be a change. And it's like throwing off an old skin and bringing forth a whole new thing. And frankly, I don't care whether I drop dead here or live another 20 years. But I'm prepared to live 20 years. And, well, the sense of expansion and fulfillment and relationships become, oh, there's a wonderful thing about relationships. No longer are they promises. No longer do they involve great dimensions into future. So that you can experience them directly right here now and use them up. They're inexhaustible. But you have the sense of this is it, right here now. And the whole life is that way. You're looking at it, let's say, for the last time, and that's a good time. And that's how I grow old anyhow. Well, then the thing about the superego and the persona, they're practically the same. That's to say, the society has put the persona on you. That's what Yeats called the primary mask. But then there's the development of your own person, your own personal sense of individuality and destiny. And this is the antithetical mask which we in our society are allowed to develop. In a traditional society, one can't do that. And this should be really centered not in society, but in the deep self. Then comes the problem of playing both games. That is to say, fulfilling your role in society with decency and with respect and with dedication. And at the same time, allowing to develop, while that is developing, this antithetical mask, your own person through it. If you put the role in society above your own development, you probably end up with a nervous breakdown sometime. I remember a young man asked me, how do I develop as an artist and at the same time support myself? I said, well, get a job. And that's a big point today. And the other thing is, when the boss says, well, if you'll work 5 hours longer a week, I'll raise your pay, say no. That's the answer there. Now, with respect to ego and the self in you, I think I've explained that, and that picture that I showed of the wolf eating the king ego and then going through the fire and King's self coming out. This is second, the antithetical mask coming out and the primary mask of ego relationship to persona. It's very important not to identify your ego with your role. The ego is playing the role and play it. The Japanese have a kind of language that they call play language, the aristocratic language. You meet a man on the street and you say, I see you're playing and being in Tokyo. And suppose his father had died shortly before, you say, I hear your father has played dying. That means you're going with it. Don't fall, dive. And when life is presenting you with calamity, move into it with enthusiasm. and you're in control in a certain way. When you go into a skid in a car, you've got to know how to steer and handle it. You just don't say to the car, well, take me with you. You govern the skid. I think that business of taking control and playing it with enthusiasm and joy. Now, another little trick I found, there are two. Being married, I have to wait for my wife very often. And that used to be tedious for me. I would always think, well, Jean should be here. Now it's 10 minutes. Now it's 20. Now it's half an hour. I wonder what the hell she's doing. And I miss 1 hour of my life that way. But if I just think, well, now here I'm sitting sometime, perhaps Jean will turn up. And meanwhile, look at all these funny people walking past. It becomes an Arabian Nights entertainment. And it's a basic thing, anyhow, about living. If you think, well, it shouldn't be this way, something else should be going on, well, then it should get neither. But if you think, oh, so okay, this way, that's kind of fine. This I learned from Alan Watts as a Zen motif, and it has improved my waiting. The other thing I found is that almost every occasion has two aspects, namely a negative and a positive one, dark side and a light side. Well, the newspapers and our critical education has trained us to look on the dark side of everything, so life's a mess. But I found that, for example, here I am with my voice going dead on me, but I'm having a bulk of the time with all these beautiful people. While that's on my mind, I'd like to thank you all for what's happened to me here. It's been an important moment. I could say, oh, gee, I'm sick, and all this kind of thing, but no, life's always got a shadow, so forget it and go on with what's nice and twinkly up there. I had a friend talk to me only last week about how to live, and he said, I go down when it's down and up when it's up, and I experience all this thing, I go through it. I said, well, I think you're crazy. when I'm driving along a corduroy road, one of those bumpy roads, I found it's possible to go at a certain speed so that you miss the dips. And that's that one.
Dear Joe, you say that myth, symbol, dream all come from the unconscious. Please comment on the differences between them. What, for example, is symbol? Is the serpent a symbol or a mythic image, or are they the same? If myth is the vision of the shaman, can myth be thought of as spiritual instruction? Messages from spirit process. perceived by special earthly ears. What is the function of myth and folktale in regulating and developing our lives? Please elaborate on the artist as myth maker. In our time, what gives artistic vision the status of myth? Two of us in the sensory awareness group have been trying to learn to experience ourselves directly, also our relationships to others and to our surroundings, without the intervention of fantasy or dream or myth. We have been enriched by the discussion of these symbolic dimensions of life, but wonder whether they could become a hindrance in some ways to allowing direct experiencing. A related question refers to your statement that some Western and Eastern monks, upon meeting, understood one another, both having experienced their myth, but that the priests trained in dogma failed to understand one another. Is the emphasis here on experience per se, or on the common elements within experience, or in the myths, or both?
Well, to begin, a symbol is something that refers to something else. For instance, if you're driving along the road and you see a sign that says Boston with an arrow, and you think, well, I've arrived. And you sit down under the sign, you don't know what a symbol is. Now, the important thing to realize about mythological symbols is that they also are pointing past themselves. And this is something that's forgotten in most religions. They sit down under the sign and they say, this is God. It's a good way to lose the message of the symbol. That's a good way to become sectarian. Now, the monk who has reached deep realizations has gone past the symbol. There's a little Zen or Chinese painting motif that shows a child and a teacher, and the teacher's pointing to the moon. This child is not supposed to look at the finger, he's supposed to look at the moon. And that's the way with symbols. Symbols are essentially of two kinds. Those that refer to something that you can see, like Boston, and those that refer to mysteries. And these mysteries are properly mysteries of the spirit. I think one of the great words in religion is the kingdom of heaven is within you. That means God is within you. And so the picture of God, or the word God, or the notion of God that you have, is pointing its finger toward you. I think the thing that's making such a success of the Oriental teachers over here is that they tell you that the signs are pointing to something within yourself, whereas the clergy very often say the sign is pointing to our church, and we'll take up a collection in the morning. This is important. It sounds funny, but it's true. Now, with respect to the serpent, well, when he bites you, it's no symbol, that's a fact. But I tried to explain something about the qualities of serpents that makes them symbolic of the power of life to throw off death. And so the serpent serves a function that way, as a symbol. Our mythology is an organization of symbols pointing to ultimate realities and truths as conceived of by those who compose and maintain the mythology. Consider the mythology of the Roman Catholic Church. There was a fall in the Garden of Eden. There was a redemption. Well, we know that there was no Garden of Eden. There were no serpents talking. So there was, in a literal sense, no fall. And if there was no fall, then what's the point of the redemption? If you look at these as historical events, they just disintegrate. Similarly, with respect to the image of the ascension of Christ, of Jesus to heaven, the bodily ascent, where did he go? No longer do we have a heaven just a little beyond the moon. I mean, it's not nice to say, but even going at the speed of light, that body wouldn't be out of the galaxy yet. When you translate these things into concrete facts, they become ridiculous. And it's talking about the cutoff from divine light in ourselves by the faults of our own nervous system and the concentration of our consciousness. And the redemption comes from throwing off the whole commitment outward. Now, with respect to the functions of mythology, there are four great functions. The first is that of opening our hearts and minds to the mystery dimension of the universe with awe and with gratitude, realizing that behind the whole net of our experiences, there is this mystery. It is beyond words. It's beyond all categories. It is not one. It is not many. Those are categories. It neither is nor is not. Those are categories. It's a fundamental, altogether mystery. And that mystery, which is transcendent of categories, is imminent within yourself. And the goal of mystical meditation is to realize your identity with that. Or in Christian worship, where the God is always kept separate, pairs of opposites, a profound active relationship to the divine principle. The second function of the mythology is to present the whole spectacle of the cosmos in such a way that through it we may experience that mystery dimension. The cosmos, the world we live in, every detail becomes, as it were, a holy picture pointing past itself, symbolic beyond itself, in the way of the judgment of symbols. The third function of a mythology is the moral or sociological one of presenting a validation for the moral order of the society that supports the mythology and is supported by it. And the fourth function is pedagogical, guiding the individual through the crises of his life, from the period of dependency of childhood to maturity and active, positive engagement in the society, in the world, and then disengagement and old age, the passage through the final door.